A long time ago, when the earth was green, there are more kinds of animals than you've ever seen. They'd run around and play while the earth was being born, but the loveliest of all was the unicorn. There are green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but sure as you're born, the loveliest of all was the unicorn. Now the Lord seen some sinning, and it gave him pain. He says, "Stand back, I'm gonna make it rain." He says, "Hey, brother Noah, I tell you what to do. Build me a floating zoo, and bring some of those green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees, some cats and rats and elephants, but sure as you're born, don't you forget my unicorn." Now Noah was there to answer the call. He finished building the ark just as the rain started falling. He marched in the animals two by two, and he called out as they went through, "Hey Lord, I got your green alligators and long-necked geese, your humpty-back camels and your chimpanzees, your cats and rats and elephants, but Lord, I'm so forlorn, I just can't see no unicorn." Now Noah looked out through the driving rain. Those unicorns were laughing and playing silly games. They're running and playing while the rain was pouring. Oh, them silly unicorns. They're green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees. Noah said, "Close the door, 'cause the rain is pouring, and I just can't wait for no unicorn." The ark rose up and drifted with the tide, and the unicorns looked up from the rocks and they cried, and the waters came down and sort of floated them away. That's why you'll never see a unicorn to this very day. It's okay, Mark, really, it is. It's okay, Mark, really.
Why did you say that?
Well, because you might think this is the ending to the song.
It's not.
But I'd have to tell your friends that in fact you'd be wrong.
Really?
You see, unicorns are magical. So when the rain started pouring, they grew themselves some wings and they took to soaring. There were green alligators and long-necked geese, some humpty-back camels and some chimpanzees. But if you're looking for the unicorn, don't be forlorn. The second star on the right and straight on until morn.
Eile toledos Noach, Noach ish tzadik tamim haya bedorosav eso Elohim hishalech Noach vayoled Noach shiloshavanim es shem es cham ve es yafes. And these are the chronicles, history, outcome, genealogy, offspring of Noach. Noach was a righteous man, tamim, complete, or to completely righteous. He was in his generation, and he walked with God. Noach had three sons, Shem, Cham, and Yafet. Yafet. The reason I read both psukim is because toledot means offspring, but it also means the story of. The word really means outcome, that which comes from something, in this case, Noah's life. And we can say that includes children, and that includes various things that happen of note during his life.
OU Israel presents
Hey welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Noach. Recording and first availability, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the second day of Mar Cheshvan, 5779, corresponding this year to October 12th. Since Yom Kippur, we have not been saying Tachanun, and today is the first day that Tachanun returns. As far as the show is concerned, it means reading of Psalm 130 rather than Psalm 121. Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tehiena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmor Yah Adonai Miya Amod Ki Imacha Haslicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Kiviti Adonai Kivita Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hochalti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mi Shomerim L'Boker Shomerim L'Boker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbe Imo Fidut. Zehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya ha'omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem alehem v'yotziyem mitzara liyirvacha umeafela la'ora umishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. The song that you heard at the beginning of the show, rather than just a clip. I played the whole song, a little more than 3 minutes. Was recorded by the Irish Rovers back in 1968. The words are a poem by Shel Silverstein, who I think wrote it in the beginning of the 60s. And I feel it's an appropriate song to relate to Parshat Noach. The poem and the song tells about the unfortunate circumstances that when Noach was building the ark, and then before the rains began, or as the rains began, he was collecting the animals to bring them into the ark, into the Teva. The unicorns, which God had expressed to Noah, were his favorites, and he should make sure that they were taken onto the ark, were busy playing around and frolicking like unicorns do. We take Silverstein's word for it. And they missed the boat, literally. And that's why you don't see unicorns today. That is a piece of fiction, we'll say. But the reason that I'm bringing it up is we have no direct evidence one way or the other that every single animal that existed was taken onto the ark and saved during the flood. Without the details, since we don't know the details, it is very, very possible that there were animals who were not taken onto the ark, and they remain antediluvian. I love using that word. Don't get too much of a chance to use it. Means before the flood, and did not survive the flood. So, bigadol, meaning in broad strokes without explaining details, again, since we probably can't, if dinosaurs as a whole genre of animals are not only extinct, but we attribute their time period at something like 65 million years ago, then in addition to the theories about a large meteorite that struck Earth, and whatever else is used to explain it, we, from a, I don't know if you could call it a scientific point of view or a non-scientific point of view, but we can suggest that dinosaurs existed before the flood, and that the flood not only killed them off, but also totally distorted the aging process, which is something that I will relate to in a moment. So let's take a look at that. I want to start the same way that I did in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits, by mentioning that if the Torah is the book of life of the Jewish people and was given by God on Sinai and through Moshe Rabbeinu to the Jewish people, then really our part of the book makes up the 95% from next week's Sedra of Lech Lecha through the end of the Torah, and that the two Sedras of Bereshit and Noach are a summary and fast forward from creation through until the birth of Avraham Avinu. And we're dealing roughly with almost 2,000 years since creation, when from that point there has not been yet another 4,000 years. So if we even take it to the entrance of the children of Israel into Canaan, which happened 40 years after the Exodus, we're talking 2480, or is it more than that, if you will excuse me? I am flipping through Seder Hadorot HaKatzar, and Knisa LeEretz Yisrael is 2,488 years since creation. 2,488 minus 1,948 leaves 540 years from the birth of Avraham Avinu until the end of the Torah. First two Sedras, which make up 5% or less of the Torah, are 1,948 years, almost 2,000 years. And then for the remaining 52 Sedras, the time slows down to covering only 540 years. So it's clear to us that the book was given to us, and we need to say a few words about the first two Sedras. And I feel very strongly that we, the Jewish people, need to see ourselves as originally part, an inseparable part of humanity, and that we remain members of the human race to this day. And as a result of the Sinai experience and our family life before that, we picked up another membership that is in B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel, in addition to our membership as B'nai Adam. B'nai Adam is the term that's used for people, but it literally means the descendants of Adam, Adam and Eve, Chava. So the Torah needs to begin, for whatever other reasons are given also, with Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And from that point, things went quite downhill over the first era of the world and the first Sedra of the Torah of Bereshit, then went further downhill for the Parsha of Noach, where the beginning tells of the flood and the devastation of the earth and all who were in it. And at the end of Parshat Noach, we have the birth and earliest life of Avraham Avinu. So we come into the picture only in Parshat Lech Lecha, so to speak, and then again in the beginning of the book of Shemot, when we are already a multitude and a nation, but we started life and remain card-carrying members of Bnei Adam, of the human race, and we should never, ever forget that. We believe that with revelation at Sinai, we were given a challenge to be above and beyond what human nature makes us. And that is a spiritual journey and a spiritual challenge, which is not incumbent upon every human being in the world. A Jew who eats a ham sandwich or a cheeseburger is in violation of the Torah which God gave to the Jewish people. A non-Jew who eats a ham sandwich or a cheeseburger, we can say to such a person, B'tei Avon, bon appetit, enjoy it. Because in our eyes, he is not doing anything wrong by eating pork and ham, by eating and mixing milk and meat. These are things that the average human being is allowed to have and is not considered any less for it. A Jew, on the other hand, has a second set of mitzvot and prohibitions, and one of them is the prohibition of meat of a non-kosher animal, and another one is the prohibition of mixing of meat and milk, and many, many, many others, which, again, I say, we recognize is not required of the nations of the world, is not the way that people become good people. It's the extra challenge of the Jewish people and any non-Jew who joins them to rise to a higher spiritual level through the rest of the mitzvot. But getting back to my first premise, we need to recognize that we are human beings. I can't say first and foremost, but I certainly can say first. You have to be a mensch, you have to be a good human being. Under the topic of forbidden food, all nations of the world, from our perspective, have one rule about food. If you're eating the meat of an animal, the animal has to be killed first. You cannot eat limb from a living animal. And that's it. Ritual slaughter is a Torah requirement for the Jewish people. Distinction between kosher and non-kosher animals is part of the Torah, not part of the rules and regulations that we believe govern all people. Eiver min hachai, yes, but all the rest is specific to the Jewish people who were given the Torah, and that includes any non-Jews along the way who committed themselves properly to the God of Israel and to come under his protective wing, so to speak, and convert to Judaism. We don't force conversion. We discourage conversion. But we accept with very, very strict rules of proper behavior towards the stranger in our midst, we accept converts to Judaism who become 100% Jewish people. Let me make something clear. Yisrael, afal pi shechata, Yisrael hu. A Jew, meaning a person born Jewish, is Jewish regardless of what he does and doesn't do. There is no way of getting out of one's Judaism. It is also a false way to put things by saying only religious Jews have to keep kosher, non-religious Jews don't. The fact of the matter is that all Jews are obligated by the Torah to keep kosher. All Jews are obligated by the Torah to observe Shabbat, and many, many more, etc. It doesn't mean that every Jew does, but it means that there is no real division of names of streams of Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, Reconstruction, religious, non-religious, Haredi, Hasidic, traditional. All of those things are handles that we have attached to help us talk about different segments of the population. But the fact of the matter is all Jews are obligated to keep the Torah. Whether they do or not, we know, is done by many people and not done by many people. And we know which are in the majority. But that's not the point. The point is we need to distinguish between the seven Noahide laws, which are obligatory from our perspective on all human beings in the world, and the 613 mitzvot and all the other things that come along with them, which are obligatory upon all Jews. So that's what Parshat Bereshit and Parshat Noach are doing here at the beginning of the Torah. And once we hit next week, we switch modes into focusing on the Jewish people rather than B'nai Noach, the descendants of Noach, which generally refers not to the Jewish people, and B'nai Adam, which is the collective term for all human beings. Okay, now let's look at this. If it was God's intention to destroy all human beings and animals and plants of the world and start all over, and as the bridge between the previous world that was totally destroyed and the new world, would be Noah and his wife and their three sons and their wives and two of every animal and seven pairs of every kosher animal to survive the destruction, then three things would have been possible. One would be a description of a miraculous destruction which accomplished wiping out everything else in the world. I apologize. I think I lost my thread. Let me start again. If God's intention was to spare only Noah and family and the samples of the animals, then it did not have to take 120 years of Noah building an ark and people asking him what he was doing. It could have been done in a divine snap of the finger where everyone would disappear with the exception of Noah and family, and start from there, be fruitful and multiply, and just now create and develop in the new world. Or it could have taken a much longer period of time if the mechanism for saving the family and the animals would have been totally natural. What we have instead is something that is natural and supernatural rolled into one. To produce a miracle that would be totally above nature could have taken a divine snap of the finger. To have that miracle played out in the course of 120 years in sometimes real normal methods. Let's say the gathering of the food onto the ark and the physical building of the ark was natural. Anyone who knew how to use wood and hammer and nails and waterproofing could have done what Noah did. Would that naturally have required 120 years to build? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it could have done in less time. Maybe it could have been done only in longer time. I would say, which some of the commentaries do, which is where I got it from, that the dimensions of the ark, which are very carefully spelled out towards the beginning of Parshat Noach, present us with a puzzle of natural or supernatural. If, from a purely natural point of view, an ark the size that is described in the Torah would not be sufficient to house all of the animals, 2 by 2 and 14 by 14 for the kosher, and if animals behaved the way they normally do, I don't think it would be possible to accomplish what Noah did. What we have, according to some of the commentaries, is a combination of nature and supernature. And it was natural enough so that we can relate to the process of doing things on a natural level with God's help, as opposed to having been done in a totally supernatural way, which we would just have as part of our collective memory, but we would not be able to relate to it. I don't know if I'm getting that across, but let me move on. Well, let me try saying things like this. Last week, I brought up the topic of scientific aging of rocks and animals and fossils and everything else. There's a process called extrapolation. It means when you can observe something within a relatively short period of time, and you have established laws of nature which govern your observations, you then make one major, major assumption. And that assumption is that everything that was, is, and will be within your actual experience actually always was way before you and will be way after you, which is not necessarily so. In school, back in Yeshiva of Central Queens, we had doors with very narrow and tall window slits, so that if you looked out the door, you can through the window, you would be able to see a very short piece of the hallway. The hallway was quite long. So let's say you were looking out that door through the window, and you see the principal walking past the window. And he's walking relatively slowly, and you could actually count the number of seconds it takes from when he comes into your sight until he leaves it. If you make an assumption that before you were able to see him, he was also walking at that same pace, and after he passes out of your field of vision, will continue to walk at that pace, then you could apply certain calculations and find out how long it took the principal to walk the hallway. But that's a big assumption, that the way he's walking now during your narrow window of observation is the way he always walked till then. You don't know whether he was running for the first part of the hallway. You don't know if he stopped to talk to somebody and was standing still for a piece of time, unknown to you, and not only unknown to you, but not part of your assumption. Because your assumption is what you are able to observe is the way that he always walked and will walk. It just doesn't work like that. So if the science approach is the decay of radioactive carbon-14 to become carbon-12, which is the stable isotope of carbon, if that process has a certain half-life, which can be subject to very accurate calculations, and that when you study the carbon in rock samples, you can conclude the age of a rock based upon the amounts of carbon-12 and carbon-14 in your sample, plus the knowledge of how long carbon-14 takes to decay, plus one super big assumption that how it behaves now is how it has always behaved, which is not necessarily so from our perspective of God's having created the world. Fast forwarding, distortion of age based on the conditions of the Mabul, the flood, and other factors of how long a day of creation was, which I mentioned last week, and all other kind of things like that, means that you have to say a rock, assuming carbon has always decayed the same way in nature, is 4.5 billion years old. Once you say, taking into account God's creation of the world, the age of the length of time that it took before day one of Yihor, the laws of nature that were in existence at the beginning, the laws of nature that continued through the early generations of humankind, all the other kind of factors that could have been different, then the best you could come up with, which is what I mentioned last week, and I remember using the word ki'ilu, this rock is ki'ilu 4.5 billion years old. Two ways of understanding that. One is 4.5 billion years ago, this rock was in its infancy, whatever that means for a rock. And the other way of looking at it is sometime in the past, there was an act of creation and a series of acts of creation and formation of the world, which make our timing not accurate and not able to be accurate unless we apply the Ke'ilu word. I hope again that I'm getting something across and it doesn't just sound like rambling, but I'll stop. Let me jump to a story that I've told before and see if I could put it within the context of Parshat Noach. A number of years ago, there was a petition by members of the Haredi community to the Badatz to remove its rabbinic certification of kashrut of Tara chocolate milk. Tara is one of the dairy companies in Israel, and its chocolate milk has a Mahadrin certification, but people wanted the Badatz to remove it. Why? Because the containers of the chocolate milk had pictures of dinosaurs on them. And this was considered a forbidden topic in certain segments of the Haredi community. Their children would see these pictures on the containers and ask, what are these animals? I never saw them in the zoo. And how do you go and tell kids that these are animals that existed 65 million years ago? So their reaction was, the Badatz should not certify the kashrut of the chocolate milk, which is, in my opinion, kind of ridiculous. What you need instead is a kosher way of understanding the dinosaur. Now, there's a question which we're not going to be able to handle perfectly well, and that is why. But before we get to the why, let's make a couple of suggestions. I believe that the human being was the target and purpose of God's creation of the world. I do not share the panic that the church had when the sun was seen as the center of the solar system and not the earth. Certain famous scientific names, the people were put into excommunication because they suggested that the sun did not revolve around the earth, but rather the earth and the other planets revolved around the sun. And this was considered a theory against the religious view that God created the world for the human being. I don't think this bothered the Jewish people at all. I don't think it should bother the Jewish people at all, because the earth revolves around the sun, and the solar system is part of a galaxy, which is part of a vast universe. And it does not take away from the concept and the belief that human beings were the reason for God's creating the earth, the world. You can create something for somebody, does not mean that it has to be in the middle. You can have it off-center or peripheral if you have a reason for it. And that's what I said before, that getting involved with why is going to be sticky, because sometimes we have an insight and sometimes we don't. But to put it very plain, I believe that the human perspective of the world into which we were created, into the universe in which we live, needed to have things that don't exist today that existed ke'ilu millions of years ago, and that if God chose to create the fossils of animals that never actually existed except in fossil form, then he was capable of doing that, and he had a reason for doing that, and he had a reason for allowing us to discover such a thing and develop our own models and theories of all of this. It might not sound scientific, but I don't believe that science is the end all in this issue. If we needed a perspective of having a powerful species of animal that existed at one time and no longer existed and could not have coexisted properly with human beings, then actually going through the time that it would take on a purely scientific timetable, or super accelerating the timing by an act of creation, or the remnants of a previous world that was created and destroyed, or the acceleration by the pressure of the Mabul and the acidity of the water and whatever else goes into that, in order to create the same result in what we see the world as we live in it, does not take away from the fact that we are the purpose of creation. And it would be too simplified to say, therefore, we have to be in the middle of everything. Therefore what? We have to be the largest of the creatures. No. We have a position in the scale of things, so long as I'm saying it that way. One of my all-time favorite quotes, and I don't remember who said it, is that human beings are so, I don't even remember the correct language here, are so unbelievably large when it comes to the very small, and so small when it comes to the very vast, that we occupy a position which is on the trivial side of total mediocrity. I look at it differently from that. We have things in our pondering that are vastly, unimaginably bigger, and we have things that are unbelievably smaller, and it gives us both perspectives in order to appreciate and enrich our lives and to ultimately fulfill the purpose that God created us. I hear myself and I know that I'm going in a direction that I can't do justice to now, but it doesn't change the fact that I feel very strongly about that. And I am always comforted by the Pasuk, Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu. There are hidden mysteries that belong to God alone, and we must recognize our finite abilities. I could go on and on if I had the time, but we don't. And I'll still have other times, Amir Tzashem, to go on and on. Let me sum it up like this. God created the world and laws of nature, that all elements of nature almost always follow faithfully without deviation. The almost always is because God himself maintains mastery and control over the entire universe which he created. And when there is need for a miracle, me'al lateva, supernatural, above nature, it's available. We believe in nature. We believe in science, but we believe that nature and science are part of God's creation. And above nature and science is Torah. And I'm not talking about conflicts. I'm talking about a commitment to a higher totality. Those in this world who are devoted to an extreme of science, I would actually suggest, even though many of them would claim to be atheists, are guilty of a form of idol worship. Instead of bowing to a golden idol, they bow to science, they bow to nature, which is not new. It has different formats, but it is something that Moshe Rabbeinu warned the people in Parshat Vaetchanan, be very careful, among other things, not to look heavenward and decide to worship the sun, the moon, or the stars. In a more modern way of putting that, is study whatever discipline you want, but remember that God created it. So if you say, okay, I want to study science, biology, physics, math, whatever, but I am not using as a premise that God created everything, then perhaps that is a form of avodah zarah, idol worship. I love nature. I love the study of science and math. I believe that you see evidence of the God who created everything in all aspects of nature and science in this world, including the world of numbers and math, but we'll get to that a different time. So I would like to conclude the show with an instrumental. I looked on YouTube to see if I could find a voiced copy that I would be happy with. I found a few and I didn't like them. This instrumental is Menny Gorman and his band, and I think it does a beautiful job of instrumental. Let me put it in perspective of the words. The words come from the bracha, which we recite right before Kriyat Shema in the morning, and that makes it very special and interesting. Listen to what I'm suggesting. We are obligated twice a day to recite the Shema. The Shema begins with the words, Shema Yisrael, Hear, O Israel, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, God, our God, God is one. Before the Jew declares and recommits to belief in one God, we have a request of God. Avinu, our Father, Ha'av HaRachaman, the merciful Father, HaMerachem, who is merciful, Rachem Aleinu, have mercy on us. V'tein b'libeinu lahavin ulahaskil, and instill in our hearts the desire to understand and discern, to listen, learn, and teach, to observe, perform, and fulfill all of the teachings of your Torah in love. The words continue, not from this particular song, but there's the other song with it. V'ha'er einenu b'toratecha, enlighten our eyes, light up our eyes, let our eyes sparkle as a reflection of our hearts with your Torah. V'dabek libenu b'mitzvotecha, and let our hearts cling to your commandments. V'yached levavenu li'ahava ul'yirah et shemecha. Unite our hearts to love and revere your name, so that we may never be ashamed. This is what we ask of God in a petition for him to help us to recite the Shema and mean it like we're supposed to say it. So I'm choosing to end the show with that petition to God, which includes the knowledge of God which we attain through the study of his world, through the study of nature, but always above that, the study and the practice and the teaching and the learning of Torah, of which the study of nature is a part. With that, today being the second day of the month, I wish you not only a Shabbat Shalom, but a Chodesh Tov, a Yishtameach.